All right, done with it. So it is now 5:30. Can you hear me all right? And I want to proceed immediately with my introduction of our speaker, whom I've known quite a while. First, I'd like to say just a very brief word or two about the careful preparation that has gone into this whole conference, as exemplified by the poster, the Goya poster, which is, whenever I have shown it to people who are at all knowledgeable about symbols and nightmares and even Spanish painting, have been impressed by the fact that the editors, probably including some of the LSE graduates whom I've known for years, chose this so well. Painting of Goya, El sueño de la razón produce monstruosos. The sleep or dream of reason produces monsters. And I think that a number of people, including Hegel, who adopted the point that civilization was often declining, as exemplified by European nationalism, is really part of our field, and we will come back to that at other times. Goya himself, an earlier admirer of the French Revolution, came to abhor its embodiment in Napoleon's conquering dictatorship. Although his quotation is in Castilian Spanish, much of Goya's life was spent in Catalonia, and the selection seems to me to be a subtle hint of that of my editor, Montserrat Guiberneau. And I are both of about as much Catalan origin as Goya. My maternal grandfather was a Menorcan Catalan by descent. Now here we have this visual shocking portrayal of fierce cats, and more especially the owls. And who are the owls? The owls of Minerva that Hegel said begin to fly only when twilight of civilization has appeared. In blunter terms, all our subtleties about social constructs like nationalism may be merely foretelling the imminent decay of our global society. And therefore, it seems very, raises a big question for us in this whole conference. Fortunately, our principal speaker today was not discouraged by such pessimistic thinking. Quite apart from its erudition and insights, Nationalism, Five Roads to Modernity, which came out in 1992, became the most important book on our subject. Professor Greenfield's book, 600 pages in length, immediately led me to think that I needed more time and space to review for history and theory than even the 17 pages it allotted to me, the longest book review I think I've ever written for a single book. To me, the most important point is modestly tucked away in footnote 16 of the introduction on pages 496 to 97. Indeed, Professor Greenfield writes, it appears impossible on the basis of empirical evidence to distinguish between real and ideal factors in society, for people's beliefs and ideas are real forces in their lives, and structures are always interformed with meaning. The only distinction that would make sense is that between systems of meanings which are embodied in social relationships and exist as inherent parts of social structures, and systems of meanings equally objective that exist, so to speak, in a disembodied form as cultural traditions, beliefs, and ideas. Culture, for short, she concludes. As I do in the review, I could continue for thousands of words quoting and criticizing shrewd sociological generalizations, all the more remarkable considering the difficult acquisition of this knowledge and her clarity in presenting it. Professor Greenfield's early training was in the Soviet Union, not indeed in its totalitarian era, but still largely permeated by the Marxism-Leninism that most of us could scrutinize at arm's length. On reaching Israel, however, Professor Greenfield could draw on instruction of outstanding sociologists, several like my friend Shmuel Eisenstadt are unsurpassed in historical sociology. But other conditions, including learning difficult languages, were less favorable. Eventually moving to a PhD program at Harvard, Professor Greenfield not only achieved an amazing command of English, but studied in sociological department, the height of its brilliance. 2 years ago, Leah Greenfield continued her sociological achievements by publishing The Spirit of Capitalism, Nationalism, and Economic Growth. Some will think of Weber in that connection, but I hope she's corrected him. But I have already said enough to convey my admiration of Leah Greenfield's scholarship. My lack of expertise on this recent subject prevents me as yet from commenting on the new work. So let us turn immediately to the speaker herself, whose remarks will act as illuminating signposts for our consideration of many difficult problems during the next 2 days.
Thank you very much, Professor Armstrong. It goes without saying, and precisely for this reason I would like to stress that I regard giving this 10th annual Gandler lecture before what is undoubtedly the most distinguished forum in the studies of nationalism, made so by the untiring activities of Professor Anthony Smith, as a great honor, which gives me an opportunity to pay personal homage at once to two great pioneers. Like my father, Ernest Gellner was born in 1925 in Paris. Like my father, he was born into a Jewish family from an Eastern European Slavic country in turmoil, Russia in my father's case, Bohemia in Gellner's. And like my father, Gellner returned to grow up in that ancestral country. Both in terms of age and in terms of intellectual background, I could be his daughter. Gellner's 1983 book, Nations and Nationalism, was a departure point for my work in the field, but as often happens between generations of parents and children, mine was a radical rather than a conservative departure. It was provoked by a profound disagreement rather than persuasion. This was a disagreement on the most fundamental level, pertaining to the ontology of our shared subject matter. While Gellner, like all sociological structuralists and philosophical materialists, regarded society and history essentially as a continuation of the biological evolution, though one must stress Lamarckian rather than Darwinian, I have based my thinking on the empirical generalization that humanity constitutes a reality sui generis, distinguished from the rest of the animal species by the symbolic, therefore not material, instead of genetic, therefore material, transmission of its ways of life across generations. This specificity, which alone makes humanity worthy of a discipline of its own, necessarily translates into the specificity of human society, because human society, in distinction to animal societies, is organized symbolically rather than materially, and into the specificity of human history, because human history, in distinction to the development of other animal societies, is subject to the regularities of cultural rather than biological evolution. And this, in turn, necessitates that the study of human historical and social processes focus on culture, considering cultural or symbolic factors as both explanans and explananda. Yet despite this fundamental disagreement, in some important way I believe I follow in Ernest Gellner's footsteps. I accept his division of the academe into the tribes of relativists, fundamentalists, and rationalists of skeptical temperament, whom he called Enlightenment Puritans, and like he, include myself in the latter group. I fully share his irreverence in regard to institutionalized departmental boundaries of anthropology, area studies, economic history, politics, and social science, all of which he crossed. This lecture indeed plans to add to this list and break the irrational isolation of several other traditions of study. I also like to think that my work continues the most inspiring trend in his, the attack on empirically unwarranted intellectual orthodoxies. Would he agree, even though the road I have taken leads me farther and farther away from his conclusions? Perhaps. After all, for Ernest Gellner, as one of his obituaries noted, being right often mattered less than throwing out good ideas to be proved wrong. It is a pity that I never had the chance to ask Ernest Gellner to draw a pictogram of nationalism. It is remarkable how much a 30-second drawing can reveal of one's understanding. I do now ask my students to draw such a pictogram in the beginning of the discussion of nationalism. They invariably draw flags and/or people with guns. When I ask them for a pictogram of nationalism at the end of the discussion, the emblem changes completely. They draw a globe and little unarmed people who sometimes say things like, "Oh, my identity." For flags and guns do not even begin to express what is central and most significant about nationalism. Nationalism, in short, is the modern culture. It is the symbolic blueprint of modern reality, the way we see and thereby construct the world around us, the specifically modern consciousness. The core of this consciousness is the image of the meaningful reality which the pictogram of the globe with people attempts to express. Being a pictogram, it can only express its immediately visible features or outlines. Even so, it captures its essential characteristics. The image of meaningful reality is secular. It is limited to this experiential world, thereby making this world, the mundane, the source of its own meaning, or ultimately meaningful. While within this world, the most significant element is the people who populate it. This image is not only secular, it is fundamentally humanistic. Why is this worldview called nationalism? For purely accidental, historically contingent reasons, specifically the use of the word nation, at the time meaning a small group embodying an authority in a conciliar ecclesiastical setting, or an elite, in regard to the entire population, the people of England. This momentous linguistic event, which occurred in the early 16th century, helped the members of the new Enrician aristocracy to rationalize the experience of upward mobility, which made no sense in the terms of, and in fact contradicted, the traditional feudal and religious image of reality. By the same token, it symbolically elevated the mass of the population to the dignity of an elite and redefined the community of the people as both sovereign, the embodiment of supreme authority, and as a community of interchangeable individuals, each with a generalized capacity to occupy any social position, or in other words, as fundamentally a community of equals. The word nation, therefore, acquired its modern meaning of a sovereign people consisting of fundamentally equal individuals, while the community defined as a nation inevitably began to be restructured as such a people. It was the definition of an earthly community as sovereign which focused attention on this world and on humanity, exiling God beyond its confines and creating an essentially secular consciousness. In its turn, the secularization of the worldview reinforced the effects of the principles of popular sovereignty and egalitarianism, which between them define the modern concept of nation. To sum up, nationalism is a fundamentally secular and humanistic consciousness based on the principles of popular sovereignty and egalitarianism. These three characteristics are present in every special case of nationalism. Modern culture, more generally, is essentially nationalistic in the sense that it has at its core the nationalist worldview and that it projects this worldview on every sphere of cultural social activity. To claim that nationalism is the modern culture is tantamount to saying that it represents the cultural foundation of modern social structure, economics, politics, international relations, education, art, science, family relations, and so on and so forth. I shall mention just the most salient of its implications for the character of modernity in the ascending order of importance, starting with the modern economy. The modern economy, contrary to a widespread belief, to put it bluntly, is a product of nationalism. For it is this vision of social reality which provided economic activity with a motivation that reoriented it from subsistence to sustained growth. The economic effects of nationalism are mainly the result of the egalitarian principle at its core. To begin with, the definition of the entire population, the people, as a nation, that is, as an elite, given the previous meaning of the word nation in its ecclesiastical context, symbolically elevates the lower classes and ennobles their activities. Economic activities in general, engaging the overwhelming majority of the people, and traditionally denigrated in pre-national societies precisely for this reason, gain status and with it a hold on the talented people who, under different circumstances, having achieved a certain level of financial independence, would choose to leave the economic sphere. Arguably of even greater moment is the fact that the symbolic ennoblement of the populace in nationalism makes membership in the nation, that is, nationality itself, an honorable, elevated status, thereby tying one's sense of dignity and self-respect to one's national identity. This ensures one's commitment to the national community, and in particular, one's investment in the nation's collective dignity, or prestige. Prestige is a relative good. One nation's having more of it implies that another has less. Therefore, investment in national prestige necessarily gives rise to endless international competition. For no matter how much prestige one may have gained at a certain moment, one can be outdone in the next. Unlike other types of societies, then, nations are inherently competitive. This competition goes on in all the spheres of collective endeavor, moral, the nation's record on human rights, for instance, pertaining to cultural creativity, scientific, literary, musical, etc., military, political. Any particular nation chooses those spheres of competence and competition where it has a chance to end on or near the top, and disregards those in which it is likely to be shamefully outcompeted. For instance, Russia has always chosen to compete on the cultural and military arenas and has never been interested in economic competition. Where economic competition is included among the areas of national engagement, however, the inherent competitiveness of nationalism gives rise to the economies of sustained, endless growth, that is, to what is recognized as modern economies. Since not all nations include the economy among the spheres of international competition in which they are willing to engage, not all nations develop the specifically economic nationalism, that is, an economic interpretation of nationalism and therefore a reconstruction of the economic activity on the basis of the nationalist image of reality. Thus, while economies of sustained growth, modern economies, cannot exist without nationalism, nationalism can exist without spawning economies of sustained growth or economic modernization. In distinction, nationalism cannot fail to affect politics, as it does not simply encourage, but logically implies, the reconstruction of political structures and processes in accordance with its fundamental principles. The essential secularism and the two principles of nationalism's image of the social world define this form of consciousness as such. And though its specific expressions or particular nationalisms are distinguished by numerous other qualities, it is these three general characteristics which explain the central political features of every modern society. The first of these central features to be listed is the democratization or universality of political action. The striking fact that in modern societies it may be found on any rung of the social ladder and in any corner of the national territory. It is this, dramatic by comparison to other types of societies, level of political participation which the term civil society as a rule describes. Indeed, it would be absurd to talk of civil society or political action in the framework of the European feudal society or Indian caste society, to mention the two perhaps best known non-modern examples. The forms of consciousness prevailing in them did not allow for the existence of such political phenomena, which still appear unimaginable to us, being logically incongruent with the two cultural frameworks. The focus of nationalism on this world as ultimately meaningful and the principle of popular sovereignty combine to render social reality changeable and place the responsibility for its shape in the hands of the earthly living community, the nation. The focus on the life in this world dramatically increases the value of this life to the individual and inevitably leads to the insistence on a good life, however defined. One is no longer expected to submit to suffering or deprivation unless one has special reasons to do so. For the general reasons for such submission, the expectation of rewards in the beyond, transmutation and migration of souls, the duty to serve witness to the glory of God wherever one is called, or the sheer impossibility to change one's condition, no longer apply. Moreover, in a self-sufficient world, changeable and shaped by people, suffering is generally believed to be man-made. Even natural disasters are likely to be so interpreted. A famine, an earthquake, or an epidemic are as often as not attributed to some human agent's withholding of the needed but available resources, or negligence. Personal misfortunes, such as debilitating, life-threatening, and incurable illnesses, are blamed on artificially created environmental conditions, secondhand smoke, lead paint, etc., or on doctors' incompetence. None of these natural disasters, it is said, have to happen. They are no longer believed to be in the nature of things. Of course, the right to a life free of suffering is most clearly asserted when suffering is caused, as it is mostly in modern societies, by social evils: war, economic or political conditions, competition for precedence, and so forth. Humiliation, rejection, thwarted ambition are felt as unjust, as contrary to expectations, and thus resulting from illegitimate intervention of malicious others. As one's precious time on earth is limited, the change in the conditions preventing the realization of one's right to a life of contentment, free of suffering, is experienced as urgent. And since those responsible for their creation are only human, any naturally active and temperamental individual who is not particularly timid easily gets engaged in whatever form the political process around him or her takes. As a result, involvement in political action or participation in civil society under nationalism is a function not of the social position as it was, let's say, in feudal and absolutist Europe or in Tokugawa Japan, but of character and personality. Since temperament changes with age, and young people, for instance, are more likely to be impetuous and unthinkingly brave, it is also a function of age. It is noteworthy that all revolutionary movements in the last 300 years, from the French Revolution to the student one of the 1960s, were movements of adolescents and people in their 20s and, to a lesser extent, 30s. It is even more significant that in the last 300 years, but never before, there were revolutionary movements, that is, explicit attempts at social change, movements oriented towards reshaping the world by human design. All forms of consciousness allow for revolts and rebellions, spontaneous eruptions of frustration and rage, essentially expressive collective actions, aimless, perhaps vaguely oriented to the righting of such tremendous but ill-defined wrongs, with goals and demands thought through, if at all, only after the fact. But revolutions are a modern form of political action. At their root always lies nationalism. The central political institution of our age, the state, is also a product of nationalism. Specifically, it is an implication of the principle of popular sovereignty. The state is not to be confused with government in general. It is only a form of government, and this form is characteristically modern and necessarily bureaucratic. The concept of state as a form of government appeared in the English of the 16th century, about 50 years after the entrenchment of the idea of the nation and well into the development of the nationalist discourse. It obviously reflected a new reality, as it did later in other countries when the term migrated there in translation. This new reality was the new form of government called forth by the new form of consciousness, which presented a new image of what a government should be. As nationalism first developed in Western Europe, this image contrasted most sharply with the then existing Western European ideal of government, the medieval ideal of kingship. The distinguishing characteristic of kingship was its personality. The government was inseparable from a particular person, a person born at a certain time to a certain family who needed no other qualifications in addition to this accident of birth, of course never regarded as an accident, and at a later stage explicitly reaffirmed as divine appointment to assume power. In contrast, the distinguishing characteristic of the state became its impersonality. Since supreme authority in the framework of nationalism resides in the body of the nation in accordance with the principle of popular sovereignty, the authority of the state is necessarily delegated, representative, in the sense that it only represents the authority of the people, and in so far as it is subject to recall, limited. Sovereignty is delegated to the office, not to any particular person, and any person exercises authority only as a holder of the office. The state is a government by officers, that is, a bureaucracy. In this sense, Adolf Hitler, the Führer who ardently believed that he represented the will of the German people, was but a bureaucrat, as was Joseph Stalin, the oppositely referred to General Secretary, who did not believe in any such thing, but made sure that everyone else did. Finally, the principle of the equality of national membership lies at the root of the open recruitment to state offices, which obviously also exerts a most profound influence on the nature of politics in modern society. It is through the principle of equality of membership, its core social principle, that nationalism affects the social structure most directly. Because in modern society, the system of social stratification, the nodal social structure in which all social systems meet and connect, is based on this principle. In this case, too, the modern or national system of social stratification represents the very opposite of the stratification system characteristic of the European feudal society, which it replaced. In place of a rigid structure, sharply distinguishing between strata of which it was composed, and except by special dispensation, allowing no movement between them, we now have an open system with loosely and only theoretically defined compartments, in practice virtually indistinguishable and seamlessly flowing one into another via the numerous channels of social mobility. One no longer has a social position and function clearly defined by birth, which is supposed to serve one, or rather, which one is supposed to serve all of one's lifetime. Instead, one is supposed to choose a function and to achieve a social position, which presupposes specifically upward mobility, moving from one social position to higher and higher ones, grows older, bettering oneself, or getting ahead. In modern societies, one does not talk of usurpers, parvenus, or however great the temptation, nouveau riche. One is expected, even encouraged, to strive, to have ambitions, to be a proficient social climber. And so there is nothing strange in a poor seminarist from Georgia becoming the all-powerful ruler of the great Soviet Union, a son of elderly underpaid Leningrad parents rising through the ranks of foreign espionage to the presidency of only slightly less great Russia, a daughter of a modest greengrocer gaining recognition as the premier of United Kingdom, and the child of a single mother unhappily remarried to a garage mechanic from Arkansas, twice being elected to head the United States of America. Our form of consciousness, nationalism, makes this kind of mountaineering normal, respectable, in fact, necessary. The combination of the principles of popular sovereignty and fundamental equality of membership implies democracy, government of the people by the people. Therefore, political recruitment must be open to any member of the nation. The process of the recruitment in the democratic, national, or modern societies differs drastically from those based on forms of consciousness different from nationalism. For whatever the differences between nationalisms, which, as I have argued elsewhere, may be very significant, it is in all nations essentially, rather than accidentally, a process of self-recruitment, always dependent on, though not inevitably determined by, individual initiative, the nature of one's ambition and talent, while in other societies it follows strictly charted paths from certain initial social positions to specified political functions which only extraordinary circumstances allow to circumvent. The egalitarian presupposition of nationalism's image of society, which necessitates an open and fluid system of social stratification, that is, the class system characterized by social mobility, makes the individual the historical agent and bases the social position or status on transferable goods of wealth and education. When the culture of nationalism is imported into a traditional society, it necessarily undermines the characteristic rigid stratification, such as that of the society of orders, a legal estate, or a religious caste system, with its status based on birth, the family rather than the individual as the historical agent, and, as a consequence, the illegitimacy of social mobility. Since the system of stratification is the nodal social structure in which all the others crisscross and influence each other, it does not exist separately but only through the others. It is therefore clear that a dramatic reconstruction of the social stratification, such as is presupposed by the emergence or importation of nationalism, will change the very nature of the existential experience of one's desires and aspirations, frustrations and fears, the very nature of one's passions, and with them both of happiness and of suffering. In the modern world defined by nationalism, one can, nay, one is supposed to make oneself. The open system of stratification allows and encourages ambition. One is free to move and is invited to shape one's destiny. Only in nations, children are asked what they want to be when they grow up. This question is inconceivable, more than that, subversive in a traditional society where one's future is determined by birth. The countless children who declare they want to become an American president or a British prime minister or whatever is regarded as the preeminent leadership position in Russia at the moment are not checked as precocious activists, arrivists. They are praised for the healthy vigor of their aspirations. And this freedom is not limited to the political or even generally occupational sphere. One can dream to become a great scholar or a multimillionaire or a heroic firefighter, or one can think not in terms of greatness at all, rather seeking self-realization as a gardener or fulfillment in love. All these are modern desires, made possible by the egalitarianism of nationalism and the system of stratification it creates. Who thought of marital happiness when marriage was a contract concluded between two families rather than a free union between two individuals, and when being a wife or a husband was a job and an office? the advantages of modernity come with a heavy price tag. The greater is the choice one is given in forming one's destiny, the heavier is the burden of responsibility for making the right choice. The more opportunities one is offered to find oneself, the harder it is to decide where to look. Life has never been so exciting and so frustrating. We have never been so empowered and so helpless. Modern societies, produced by nationalism, because of their very secularism, openness, and the elevation of the individual, are necessarily anomic. As was recognized already by Durkheim, anomie is the fundamental structural problem of modernity. Anomie, commonly translated as normlessness, refers to a condition of cultural insufficiency, a systemic problem which reflects inconsistency or the lack of coordination between various institutional structures, as a result of which they are likely to send contradictory messages to individuals within them. On the psychological level, anomie produces a sense of disorientation, of uncertainty as to one's place in society, and therefore as to one's identity, as to what one is expected to do under circumstances of one sort or another, as to the limits to one's possible achievement, that is, aspirations that would be frustrated, on the social, political, economic, and personal planes. In acute cases, such a sense of disorientation and uncertainty leads to depression, deviant behavior, even to suicide. On the social level, pervasive anomie necessarily increases the rates of depression, deviance, and suicide. Indeed, Durkheim's classic discussion of the phenomenon occurs in his study of the rates of suicide. Anomie may occur in all types of societies, but in modern society, it is a built-in feature. One cannot have modernity, one cannot have nationalism without anomie. Anomie is, in fact, the ultimate cause of cultural change. It both breaks the old cultural routine and encourages the formation of a new one. The general pattern of human history can be imagined as an alteration between relatively brief and rare periods of widespread, though culturally localized, anomie and cultural routine. Widespread anomie, most commonly implying gross inconsistencies between elements of culture impinging on individual identities, specifically inconsistencies within the system of social stratification, which defines a person's position in the social world in general and vis-a-vis particular others, affects large groups of individuals and expresses itself in social turmoil. A readjustment of the stratification system in the course of such turmoil eliminates these inconsistencies, that is, resolves anomie, making again possible unhindered development of identity and routine functioning of both the individual and the surrounding culture. But modern culture, and as a result, modern history, does not fit this pattern. Nationalism, the novel vision of reality, which was the formula 16th century Englishmen used quite successfully so far as they were concerned, to resolve their particular anomic situation, turned out to be anomic and anomie generic vision. Thus, it has produced a culture, meaning a society, a polity, an economy, the entire organization of human life, in short, in which anomie is built in. In modern culture, in other words, the cultural routine itself is anomic. We live in a constant condition of anomie. as much as the open class structure, the state and civil society, and the modern economy characterized by sustained growth in nations which choose to compete in the economic arena. Anomie is an implication of the nationalist image of reality, representing a condition of cultural insufficiency. It inhibits the formation and normal functioning of the human mind. I am therefore proposing that nationalism inhibits the formation and the normal functioning of the human mind. On the most general level, culture is the process of transmission of historical ways of life and forms of human association across generations and distances. As I mentioned in the introduction to this lecture, in distinction to other animal species, such transmission of ways of life and social organization, in the case of humanity, is not genetic but symbolic. Humans are the only biological species, the continuation of whose existence is dependent on symbolic transmission. The products of this cultural process are stored in the environment within which our biological life takes place. But the process itself goes on inside us. In other words, culture exists dynamically, develops, regenerates, transforms only by means of our minds, which makes culture a mental process. Let me reiterate, culture is a symbolic and a mental process. The fact that it is a mental process means that it occurs by means of the mechanisms of the brain. The fact that it is a symbolic process means that its logic cannot be reduced to the logic of the brain mechanisms, that it is an emergent phenomenon and the reality sui generis. In other words, the neural processes by means of which the cultural process occurs serve only as boundary conditions outside of which it cannot occur, but are powerless to shape the nature and direction of the cultural process. In contrast, culture itself consistently directs the brain by means of which it occurs, forcing brain mechanisms into patterns of organization and operation, which, though obviously not impossible, are most improbable given all that we may know of the biological functioning of the brain. Most importantly, culture creates the human mind. The mind is also a symbolic and a mental process. It is supported by biological brain mechanisms, but is generated by culture outside of the human brain. The mind is, one may say, an individualized culture process or culture in the brain. The products of this individualized process are stored primarily in the brain memory. Memory is a faculty humans share with the rest of the animal world. Human memory is therefore made precisely of the physico-chemical stuff that any animal memory is made of. Another mental capacity humans share with other animals is the capacity for learning, namely for committing to memory experiences of encounters with the environment and adapting to the environment as a result of such experiences. However, in addition to the mental processes such as learning and memory, which are characteristic of the entire animal world and can be fully accounted for by neurobiology without recourse to anything exogenous to the nervous system, there are clearly mental processes in which the human brain is involved because it participates in the symbolic process of culture. These uniquely human mental processes include identity, will, and symbolic imagination. The mind is a collective name for the complex interaction among these symbolic mental processes. For heuristic purposes, the mind may be seen as a symbolic system, and it is highly likely that to this symbolic system there corresponds a neurological system in the brain, the system of specific brain mechanisms and spaces that support the constituent processes of the mind. The term identity refers to symbolic self-definition. It is the image of one's position in the sociocultural space and the image of the relevant sociocultural terrain itself. It contains and provides information regarding one's social status, one's relevant others, and the types of relations one is supposed to have with them, one's immediate and more remote social world, expectations one may have of one's environment, and vice versa, conduct proper to one under various likely to arise circumstances. In short, one's identity represents an individualized microcosm of the culture in which one is immersed, with the image of one's significant sector in it, which may include God and his angels, paradise and hell, one's immediate neighbors, colleagues, and fellow fans of the local football team, magnified and highlighted. Unlike other animals who carry their social order and the individual organism's position in it in their genes, humans have to figure out their social order and their position in it out for themselves, which involves representing both in one's mind. Identity, therefore, is a symbolic self-representation, an image a human individual has of oneself as a cultural being and a participant in a cultural universe. At the same time, it is clearly an essential element of human mental functioning and health, that is, of one's ability to function cognitively and emotionally and to adjust socially. Problems in identity formation and maintenance, that is, crisis of identity, doubts about one's identity, multiple identities, are immediately evident in and directly affect one's ability to learn and commit information to memory.
You have only about 10 minutes.
Yes. Okay. The adequacy of one's emotional reactions and the degree of one's social adjustment. Identity is literally the central human mental process, for it mediates between one's natural or biological capacities to learn, memorize, adapt to the environment, and one's functioning as a person. Like all mental processes, identity must be supported by brain mechanisms. Because it is a uniquely human mental process, however, we cannot establish what brain mechanisms these are and explore them in experimenting with animal brain. Since animals perform their social functions based on genetic instructions and do not need to have a representation of an identity in their brain, they do not have an identity. Still, the representation of an identity within the brain may be analogous to the cognitive map of the spatial environment in animals, such as was found encoded in the firing pattern of the hippocampal pyramidal cells in mice, for instance. I mentioned that such processes as identity can be imagined as structures. Symbolic imagination cannot be so envisioned. It is analogous, rather, to a tendency or an ability of a living entity such as breathing. Symbolic imagination is the central faculty of the human mind on which every one of the mind's functions and its very formation depend. It is the ability to create new information within the brain and therefore the creative mental ability par excellence. We live in a symbolic universe. And our world represents a multidimensional fabric of different symbolic systems. The most intricate symbolic system is language. But there are lots of others, some of which we can call body language. A dog is instructed when to wag his tail and what precisely this means genetically. But nobody gives us instructions applicable to all our circumstances, when to smile forcibly and when to refrain from smiling, when to look and when to avert one's eyes, when to answer a greeting eagerly and when to wait for 5 seconds before acknowledging it. And yet we all participate in such symbolic exchanges and usually do it correctly. The operative logics, that is, the principles of consistency in different symbolic systems are different. Moreover, in all of these logics, with the exception of the Aristotelian logic, the principles are context-depending and constantly changing. Symbolic imagination, in essence, consists precisely in the ability to figure them out in different situations, and on the basis of such figuring out, construct one's behavior. How can we systematically move between logics, often combining blatantly contradictory principles? We can do this apparently because under the influence of our cultural experience, our brain has evolved mechanisms. Collectively, they support the agency we call will, which for every event select the logic appropriate to the context while suppressing other logics. We are able to deploy our imaginative capacities correctly, namely in accordance with the appropriate symbolic logic, thanks to the will. While the will's arbitrage, much as our capacity to learn and memorize, is mediated by identity. Clearly, it would be much easier for a person unambiguously self-defined as a soldier to risk his life in the face of mortal danger rather than try to save himself. His identity will, in effect, screen the logic of self-preservation from him, making him, so to speak, single-minded in his sharp awareness of the dictates of proper soldierly conduct. A person unsure of whether being a soldier is really him, in contrast, will be more likely to hesitate and run for cover. And this brings us back to nationalism. The modern culture, at the core of which lies the vision of nationalism, with its presuppositions of fundamental equality of national membership and popular sovereignty, and its secular focus, the inherently and pervasively anomic culture, cannot provide one with a clear social map and the sense of a defined, stable position on it. The picture one receives changes from moment to moment, constantly reorienting and confusing one with changing, often contradictory directions. Though the mapped or pictured reality in question is cultural, it is mapped or pictured mentally, that is, using available brain mechanisms and in a manner, as I suggested, analogous to the way physical terrain is mapped in the brain of a mouse. The effect on the mind of nationalism, therefore, is comparable to the effect on the brain of a mouse of an incessantly and irregularly changing physical environment, produced, for example, by holding the mouse by its tail and twirling it in the air. No neuroscientific experiments are required to understand that such action would destroy the animal's mental equilibrium and make it sick. In the cultural framework of nationalism, one's status is no longer defined by birth, and for this reason, any social position can no longer be equated with identity. Identity ceases to be a cultural given, which is formed naturally as one grows into one's social environment. The particular environment to which one grows is not necessarily one's own. In modern societies, the individual is expected to be the maker of one's own destiny, to make oneself, which implies the creation of a proper environment for oneself. And to be able to do so, one has first to find oneself. Self-definition becomes a matter of choice and responsibility. Instead of being a product of simple learning and commitment to memory of symbolic information from the outside, the construction of identity is turned into a task for creative symbolic imagination, the mental faculty dependent on identity for its routine operation. In this way, nationalism, it may be said, in fact creates a new breed of men. It modifies the way the mind is formed and functions, producing on the one hand a small number of exceptionally creative people, and on the other, a much larger minority of permanently disoriented, confused, and often unhappy individuals. Of course, the effects of nationalism depend on the psychological predispositions of human beings. But notwithstanding this dependence on innate predispositions of individuals, the more open is the cultural system, the more perfect is the realization of the core principles of nationalism in the institutions of a society, the more pervasively anomic it will be, and the greater will be the effects of anomie. The more insistent is the society upon the verity that everyone is created equal, the more intolerable will become one's inequality to the very best or even the better off. The more kinds of ambition a culture makes possible, the more varieties of self-doubt and envy it creates. Ambition drives creativity. Self-doubt and envy destroy one's sense of equilibrium and impair mental health. The negative effects of the anomic modern culture created by nationalism outnumber the positive ones. There are far more people who are made deeply unhappy by the openness and pluralism of modernity than those who are made happy. It is not a coincidence that socially paralyzing mental disorders are a scourge of the most prosperous and freest nations, that their rates grow together with life expectancy, and as problems caused by the physical environment recede. There is an epidemic of depression among America's teenagers and young adults. And as in everything, America is likely to be followed very closely by Great Britain and its statistics, ranging from mild but nearly universal state of malaise to severe physically destructive illness, which may drive those young people to suicide, and even if it doesn't, disables and often destroys their lives. To relate this to the poster announcing my talk that Professor Armstrong mentioned, it is not the sleep of reason that leads to monsters of madness, but the fact that reason is allowed no rest. Nationalism demands from the individual mind to do the work which other cultures take on themselves. Therefore, it overworks the brain and fatigues it into stupor. In my earlier work on nationalism, I have shown what profound effect it has on the political consciousness and behavior of the modern man. In my recent book, The Spirit of Capitalism, which expanded on the investigation begun in Nationalism, Five Roads to Modernity, I attempted to draw attention to the formative influence of nationalism on the modern man's economic activity, specifically its role in producing economic growth. The aim of my talk today was to indicate the direct link between nationalism and our modern man's mental formation and health. If I am right, deeper, more accurate understanding of nationalism, of that modern consciousness, the modern image of reality, may be the key to the treatment of ever-spreading mental disorders, which have called modern psychiatry and clinical psychology into being, and which modern psychiatry and clinical psychology have been trying in vain to cure. More than that, a deeper, more accurate understanding of nationalism may be the key to the very problem of happiness and unhappiness. Those assembled here have been aware for many years, often in the face of opposition from politicians, the media, and our own academic disciplines, of the tremendous importance of our subject. It may, in fact, be far more important than even those assembled here have believed.
Thank you so much. We obviously do not have any real time for discussing all these very comprehensive treatments of the modern predicament. But I think it's possible, as I said at the very beginning of my introduction, that this is the keynote for the discussion that's going to take place during the next 2 days. So you will have a chance to express your questions, and you will be with us most of that time, Leah, won't you? So we stand adjourned for the moment, and I'm sure some of you will have some personal questions.
You wouldn't take those questions now. There are some people raising hands now.
Thank you. My name is Levente Borbély, and I am from Hungary. But I was born in Transylvania, which is the homeland of five ethnical groups: Hungarians, known; Seclars, almost unknown worldwide; Saxons, known more or less in the German world; Romanians and Gypsies. Now, it was very interesting for me when you made a comparison between the feudal societies and the modern societies, which are the societies of nations. And you gave, you highlighted that kind of openness which did not exist in the feudal societies, which allowed somebody who was a very poor child of a shoemaker in Georgia to become comrade Iosif Vissarionovich Stalin, which is true. This now Transylvania, a former eastern Hungarian land, is under Romanian occupation. I am not a Romanian. And I witnessed such kind of things in the Romanian society. Very small people, they became a great. Comrade Ceausescu, the dictator, was, and his wife as well. Now, All right. Thank you for helping me. Okay. Yeah. All right. But something happened. If you were not a member of the main nation, you couldn't achieve almost anything. I don't want to be in contradiction with you, but this is any rule has an exception. Now, my question is the following, is a short one. Do you think the apparition of nations is an obligatory phenomenon? So if on another planet that there is life, and intelligent life, is it obligatory they to have some kind of societies which are national?
Thank you. I think we'll consider that too in our subsequent days of debate.
You shouldn't.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
So I'm afraid we'll have to close at this point and. Nobody got up to leave. Nobody got up to leave.